Hey, good evening. Welcome, everyone, to the 529 Emergency Preparedness Discussion Net, courtesy of the WA7ABU 529 repeater. This is Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo. My name is Brett, and I'm net control for today, April 10th, 2020. This net meets each Tuesday and also Friday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. local time on 145.29 megahertz, as long as we have the COVID rapidly changing conditions, we'll try to do that. Anyway, this is a designated emergency frequency, so we'll break if any real emergency occurs. Our alternate frequency is 145.19 with a tone of 100. We appreciate those who stand by and allow us to have a clear frequency for the next hour as we discuss emergency preparedness with particular emphasis on the COVID-19 pandemic. We have again this evening a special guest, Sheila Sund, MD, who will answer your questions about COVID-19. All amateur operators are welcome to participate in COVID-19 discussions during this net. Now, just a couple rules. We're going to try to limit one question per person, at least at the beginning, so we get as many questions as possible. I'll limit the number of check-ins we'll just do like 5 minutes of check-ins, and then after that, we'll have the doctor give us an update of COVID-19 status report, if you will, and then we'll open it up for questions, at which point in time you can come in and give a call sign and ask a question. If we get through everybody, and then you can ask other questions, more than one. Just want to make sure we get everybody's questions answered this evening. Okay, again, when you check in, please identify with your call sign slowly and phonetically, and also your name and location to be recognized by net control. Let's start first. Is anybody on Echolink that would like to check in for the Emergency Preparedness Net COVID-19 edition? Okay, not hearing anyone there, so let's go ahead and take general check-ins for the Emergency Preparedness Net.
Kilo 5, Charlie, Papa, Charlie, Mike, and Happy Valley, no question.
W7 November Alpha Tango Nate.
Okay, let's pause just a second there because I missed. Was it Richard that I missed? I mean, okay, I got Nate there. Whiskey 7 November Alpha Tango. We got Kilo 6 Sierra Tango X-ray Dan. We have Mike, Kilo 5 Charlie, Papa Charlie. And there was one other in there. Who did I miss? Okay, yeah, there you go, Richard. There's so many Richards, you know. If I just say, was that Richard, I'd probably come up with somebody coming back. Yeah, good. Richard's going to make a recording of tonight's session. And I tell you what, if Richard has a question, and what I'll do is I'll repeat it so we know what his question was, because when he's keying up, it doesn't show up on the recording. Okay. Anyway, anybody else want to check in tonight?
Kilo Foxtrot 7, Bravo Uniform Victor. This is Walton Woodburn.
Good evening, everyone. Whiskey 7, India Victor November, Ivan in Albany.
Okay, there's Ivan, Whiskey 7, India Victor November, and Walt, Kilo Foxtrot 7, Bravo Uniform Victor. Welcome to the Emergency Preparedness Net. Anybody else?
Kilo India 7, Foxtrot Whiskey Hotel, Alan, and Kilo India 7, Foxtrot Whiskey Papa, Jennifer, Salem.
Golf 7, Golf Charlie Yankee, South Salem, this is Lee.
Whiskey 7, Victor Hotel November, Frank in Lebanon.
Well, good evening, Brett. Just making sure I had it. Kilo 1. Victor, India, November for a check-in.
Kilo Echo 7, Oscar Lima Uniform, Paul in Northwest Portland.
November Whiskey 7, Oscar Romeo, and November 7, Delta Kilo Bravo, Richard and Deborah in Albany.
Kilo 9, Romeo Charlie Papa, Richard and Dundee.
Kilo Foxtrot 6, Foxtrot Yankee Delta, Richard in Salem.
Okay, that's enough Richards. No more Richards for tonight. Just kidding. That was Kilo Foxtrot 6, Foxtrot Yankee Delta, Richard. And then before that was Kilo 9, Romeo Charlie Papa, Richard. And then we had Richard and Deborah, November Whiskey 7, Oscar Romeo, and November 7, Delta Kilo Bravo. Before that was Kevin, Kilo 1, Victor India November. We had before that Frank, Whiskey 7, Victor Hotel November. I said that. And let's see, Lee checked in from CERT program there in South Salem. Kilo Golf 7, Golf Charlie Yankee. We had Alan and Jennifer check in. And Kilo India 7, Foxtrot Whiskey Hotel. And Kilo India 7, Foxtrot Whiskey Papa. I think that, let me just sort of stop there. Four Richards, you know, we've got enough people. So anyway, let's just stop there, and we'll take more check-ins as we go, so that we can get through your questions tonight. So again, I will welcome our special guest. This is Sheila Sund, MD. She's our COVID-19 expert, who is a retired physician and has been researching all of these topics since January, and tries to stay up on the news on your questions and. I'm going to hand it over to her and for an introduction here to what we're going to talk about this evening, as well as taking your questions. Here's Sheila.
I want to talk a little bit tonight about having illnesses other than COVID when the rest of the world is focused on COVID. I've had the unpleasant experience in the past week of having my mother, who chooses to live alone in Los Angeles despite being 87 years old. She got very sick, and I had to have her hospitalized in a hospital down there, and it was the most miserable experience she or I have ever had. The doctor didn't examine her for 48 hours until she had a negative COVID test. For that first 48 hours, the nurse would come in as quickly as possible to check her IV and medications and leave, and she spent most of the rest of the time alone. And again, she did not have COVID. They were so poor at trying to figure out what was wrong with her, I actually took her out of the hospital against medical advice because I figured if I got her home, I might be able to do a better job of caring for her with hiring somebody to come and take care of her than having her stay in a hospital. But even that has been difficult because there are no physicians anywhere in Los Angeles that will actually see her outside of a hospital setting. Even though the rules say that doctors should use telehealth for patients that don't need to come in, but if they need an exam, they should still have a visit. That's no longer available. Now, I don't know if that's everywhere, but it is. Some of the stuff I've been reading elsewhere has shown that the number of people even going to the hospital for heart attacks, for bleeding, for all the things that normally send them to the hospital are going way, way, way down. And nobody's quite sure. After my personal experience this week, I'm starting to wonder whether it's that people, if they can't talk to their doctors or be seen by their doctors, they figure, oh, well, I just stay at home and make it through or not on my own. So I was curious if anybody has had any experiences at feeling like they needed medical care during this and couldn't get it. I'd love to have people talk about that. And I also wanted to point that out, just in case you do have problems, that you're going to have to be an incredibly strong advocate for yourself to get medical care if it's not COVID-related. And then one other thing which I found today, which is kind of cool, it is COVID again. It's a website. It's C19Oregon.com, and it's a symptom checker. You literally check the boxes and ask how old you are, what your symptoms are, what your underlying medical conditions are, and it will tell you based upon that what you should be doing. Should you call your doctor? Should you go to the emergency room? Should you be in the hospitalized? Should you go to work? It's a very cool and very easy thing to use if you have symptoms and you're not sure whether it's COVID or whether they're bad enough to try and get somebody to see you. So I think I'll leave it at that and open it for questions.
I had one, K6STX.
Okay, Dan, go ahead with your question.
And this had to do with testing. Appears that the state of Oregon has come up with a private people for testing. They say now in rural areas, and they said they can get this within, 5 minutes or something, the results. Now, the last time we talked about this type of a test, you said it was not very efficient or problematic as to whether they're going to get a really good answer. These new private tests, are they still the same, or have they improved it now?
This is the rapid test that we talked about sometime in the last week or so. It's made by Abbott. It's designed to be done easier and quicker, but it has not been well studied, and a lot of us are suspicious that it won't be as sensitive, i.e. that there'll be more people that they don't have it when they really do. It's being given to the rural areas because they have the least access to a regular lab that can run the test like we have here. In addition, it's still in very short supply. Every state was given a very limited number of these testing kits by Abbott, and they had to decide how to use them. So in Oregon, knowing that we have a lot of areas in Oregon which have almost no hospital access at all. And so Oregon decided the best place to put them was in those areas.
In short, then, they're no different than what we've had in the past, that they're still like maybe a 30% rate that may or may not be good.
Yep, I don't actually believe any statistics on it. I would say that there's probably going to be at least a 30% false negative. It may even be higher. The only good thing about them is that they're faster. So they could be done like at a doctor's office or at a clinic setting without having to have a full hospital lab available.
Thank you, K6STX. Doesn't sound very promising.
Okay, yeah, once again, she gave out a website there, and I wanted to make sure people got a fill on that, that the website she mentioned, which is the symptom checker, it is called C19Oregon.com or Charlie19OscarRomeoEchoGolfOscarNovember.CharlieOscarMike, and that is a check your risk for COVID ID, get started symptom checker there. So, looks like it's sponsored by different Clackamas, Multnomah County, and Washington County health departments. Okay, any other questions for Dr. Sun tonight about COVID-19 or things that you've read in the news about it? Questions?
K9RCP with a kind of an announcement in the tech world about COVID-19.
Okay, yeah, go ahead, Richard, with your tech world announcement.
Yeah, this is Kilo 9, Romeo Charlie Papa. Within the last 8 hours, it's been made public that Google and Apple have come together, surprisingly, which is awesome. They're creating an application programming interface for mobile devices, and the whole entire, system to basically basically, both Android and Apple devices will admit, and you have to, this is coming in the next couple of weeks maybe, it'll be rolled out. But basically, it's a Bluetooth signal that your device will send out, and has a rolling key. Those signals get received by other devices. So your device, you have to opt in for this whole thing, by the way. And it collects those unique identifiers in the time. And then if you test positive for COVID-19, you tell them that you're infected, and you know your unique identifiers become, or not unique identifiers. Let me roll back. The rolling identifiers that are put out by your device get sent to a database, which other people that are, that also have this app would receive those unique identifiers. If they match, then it will tell you, or tell them, I should say, that they were in contact with said person, or not said person, but it was in contact with someone that potentially had COVID-19, or that tested positive for COVID-19 is what I'm saying. That uses Bluetooth. From the way it sounds like and the architecture that they've mentioned, it seems light tracking, but it's completely anonymized, other than the fact that there's a central server that kind of facilitates for both parties, for Apple and Google. China, they've been doing actual tracking of where people are going, and basically the same thing, but actually logging it. This is a more decentralized and a more anonymized version of that. So with an update on your phone, and you opt into it, your phone becomes a beacon that is anonymized, but you can still track if you come in contact with someone that tested positive. So that's some really cool stuff that's coming out in the tech world for COVID-19 to help prevent, know if you were potentially near someone that tested positive eventually. But again, it only works if people, come out. KNNR should be back tonight.
I'm glad they're doing it. It's what we need, one of the things that we could use, I should say, not what we need, but one of the things we could use to move forward from the era of everything being shut down like it is right now. People, as hoped for, are starting to come up with a number of models of how America could slowly get back to work, and what they're talking about phase two. Phase one is right now what we're doing, extreme social distancing, where we're trying to flatten the curve and increase our healthcare capacity. Phase two means that we're going to try to find ways to relax our social distancing, not get rid of it. And in fact, if you're over 60 or have medical problems, you're probably still going to be socially distanced for a long time, maybe not quite as bad now. But the question is, how do you do phase two to get people back into the community? Option one is basically what you've just heard about from Google and Apple, which is, allows to implement a surveillance on a mass scale. And the plan for this is that every American would hopefully have this app on their phone that would geo-track their movements. And then if somebody is diagnosed as positive, everybody that was in contact with them is alerted and hopefully would start social quarantine. This is actually what they've been doing in South Korea very successfully all along. There have been a few problems in that. Yes, they don't tell the person that was tested positive, but it's been fairly easy to guess who that was. You were 2 feet away from somebody in Starbucks, and they were tested positive, and you knew it was on Saturday at 10. Chances are you can guess pretty well. So I'm not sure how they're going to handle that level of privacy. That's been a bit of a problem in South Korea. There's also been some shaming associated with that in South Korea. There has also been questions about if they have this information, would they use it to enforce quarantine on those who tested positive or those who were in close contact with them? And so there would need to be some fairly significant legal restrictions on how it was going to be used, and no one's really sure how that's going to work politically in this country where we have much greater concerns about privacy.
K1VIN question. Okay, this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, and we have emergency preparedness net. Go ahead, Kevin, with your question.
Yeah, I'm not real sure how they're going to handle this Bluetooth thing. I'm in and out of restaurants all day long. Well, especially like today. I keep my distance further than 6 feet from anybody that I don't just quickly walk past to stand in my area that is 6 foot away. I'm more concerned about the contact with the front door and contact with commonly shared surfaces than I am about, you know, somebody that's not coughing, not showing any symptoms, standing 6 feet away from me. Is this something that I should really be worried about? And I'm not spending any time next to anybody's for any length of time, so their normal breathing I'm not so worried about. I guess at this particular point, do I be concerned about those type of things? You know, that I could possibly be a carrier and not know? Or should I be really more focused upon the commonly shared areas like door handles and, you know, things like that? K1VIN.
That is an evolving question. We do know, first of all, that there are a lot of people that are infectious that are completely asymptomatic. That has been suspected from the beginning and may have even been, you know, tried to cover up a little bit. But now there's no doubt. We don't know how high that number it is because we're not testing enough people. But they're guessing that probably at least 20% of the people that are infected are asymptomatic. And some people have suggested as much as 50% of the people that are infectious are asymptomatic. We won't really know that until we can start testing large groups of people to see how many of them are positive without ever having had symptoms. But we do know it's happening. As far as the risk for you individually, clearly you still want to watch out for all those infected surfaces. But we also have learned that there is COVID in the air in certain circumstances. We know that if you spend a long time sharing the same airspace of a relatively small room, i.e. a house, a conference room, a patient room, that there is enough virus floating in the air in those rooms that if you spend a fair amount of time in there, you might breathe it in and get sick from that. But we can't tell you how small is small and how long is long to be there. We do know that if you just walk, pass through somebody 6 feet away and you're in an open space like a big grocery store or even better outside, no chance of getting infected. But if you're sharing a restaurant space with somebody that's asymptomatic and breathing it into the air, we don't really have that answer right now. But we didn't even used to be officially worried about it. Some of us, like me, have thought it's been a problem all along. But now we are at least starting to consider that as a problem. So far, we're not finding clusters in places like restaurants, but we are finding clusters in places like choir rehearsals, as well as all the cruise ships and things like that, where people have clearly passed it on asymptomatically to people in closed rooms around them.
Okay, Richard, go ahead with your question, and I'll go ahead and repeat it so it shows up on the recording. Okay, just to paraphrase your question there again, Richard, so, you know, going with the federal guidelines that people should wear masks when they go out, he's asking about the different types that he's seen, three different types, a homemade bandana-type mask, a pleated type mask that might be be used by health workers or CERT members, and a dust type mask that you might get at a big box store for construction work. And I wanted to know whether those what those do. Here's Sheila.
The basis of the government recommendation and the thought behind the masks is to keep asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic people from getting other people sick. Wearing those masks, any of those three masks, including the healthcare one, will not keep you from getting sick if you are exposed to enough virus in the air around you. But if you happen to be carrying the virus and don't know it, it should cut down on the amount of virus that you're dumping out into the environment around you. The question is how much, and there are really not very many answers to that. We know that the surgical masks that the healthcare workers are wearing, they are very good at blocking virus particles that would come out of your mouth and nose, but you shouldn't be wearing one of those in public because they are limited to the use of healthcare right now because of the extreme shortage. So even if you have one sitting at home from your CERT backpack, and I do too, I would be kind of embarrassed to wear it in public right now because it is really not socially acceptable. We were supposed to donate them. I just didn't do it for the one or two masks that I have. The second question is about the dust mask ones, and I'd have to look at them, but I have a feeling that they tend to get damp fairly easily. And any kind of face mask that can get, you know, damp if it gets water or spit or moisture on it, they're not going to work as well to keep the virus from going through. Once you wet a surface, the virus can slip through much, much, much easier. So whatever you wear as a face mask, you want it to be reasonably impervious from, you know, just a little bit of moisture. That usually means it can't be paper-based. Most of the fabrics probably are adequate in that regard, providing you don't, like, truly spit on them or dump water on your face. Lastly, the homemade fabric ones, that's what you're supposed to wear now if you are going out and going to be around a number of other people in an enclosed space like the grocery store or the pharmacy. And again, it's not to keep you from getting sick. It's to keep you from getting others sick if you happen to be an asymptomatic carrier. We don't know what the best kind of those are. We haven't tested how well they work, but it makes sense that, you know, if you're coughing and sneezing, that at least a fair amount of the virus would go into the fabric and not into the air. And so that's the reason for recommending them. I think another part of it, it's a very visible reminder to the rest of the world out there that you're taking this seriously. And I think there's some value in the solidarity of that, but you still won't find me wearing one when I'm out taking a walk in the park.
Okay, and this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. We have the Emergency Preparedness Net COVID-19 question and answer session with Sheila Sund. I will just add one thing that it is required to wear such a mask if you ride the bus in Salem. To ride the Chariots bus, you do have to have a mask on. That's not optional. So you may want to have one around if you're a bus rider. Okay, I guess at this point in time, it's 7:30. You've got about a half hour left. Any more check-ins and questions? If you have a question and you want to check in, you can do that at once. So go ahead.
KB7, PPM. Oh, with a question or statement.
Okay, yeah, there's Kilo Bravo 7, Papa Papa Mike, Paul. Yeah, go ahead with your question.
Oh, it's not a question, I'm sorry. It's a statement. KB7 VZL sent me this website. I'm assuming a lot of people know about this website. It's called newsbreak.com, N-E-W-S, break, B-R-E-A-K, one word, .com. I thought it was pretty fascinating that they're collecting all this data and they share it with the public. So some of you guys can take a look at it. It's pretty neat. It tells the breakdown from the countries, the states, including Oregon, of course, and they specify cases, recovery, and death, and the changes. So you guys take a look at it. It's pretty neat. KB7 PPM, back to net control.
Okay, yeah, so that's newsbreak.com. We'll have Sheila take a look at that. One thing that's important to do when you find a news aggregate spot, and I've noticed this, you know, like I look at Google News and things like that, that a lot of different media outfits spin the wording on different findings. Okay, so you have to make sure it looks like it's a reasonably good one, but make sure when you look at one of the things, try to go to whatever the source is. If this is one that gives you the source, then go to the source. You know, so that's whatever news source that you go to. If it says, you know, doctors said this, you know, try to find out where did they say that. Okay, So anyway, this looks like a decent place as far as having a variety of articles, but you will find that different news sources have different spins on the. You'll get the same information presented in with different headlines, for example, which will, you know, make you want to read more, but they may or may not be true. Got to look at the main source. Anyway, that looks like a reasonable one, though. Thank you, Paul. Any other questions? Come now, please.
Whiskey 7 Sierra Hotel, Mike.
Okay, Steve, Whiskey 7 Sierra Hotel, Mike. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I do. It seems to me for testing, I mean, if we're wearing masks so we don't infect others with our breathing, then why does testing up the nose have to be done instead of just blowing your nose?
The reason we need to do testing is because the mask is only going to partially eliminate the virus. We haven't done any studies of it on COVID, but they've done a little bit of studies in the past about seeing how well it helped prevent the transmission of things like influenza. And it was better than nothing, but it was probably only decreased the rate of infection by maybe 1 out of 3. So, again, we don't know that with COVID, but I'm not a huge fan of the masks. I get why they're doing them. If we had enough surgical masks that we could all wear surgical masks, I'd probably be a bit bigger fan. But I just don't find any good data out there that these new face masks are going to be that helpful in preventing the disease from spreading around. Maybe a bit, and I think that's why they did it. But there's no scientific evidence to say yet that it's going to make a major difference in the transmission of the disease.
Can blowing your nose get an adequate sample?
No, it doesn't work that way because the virus actually invades the cells in the lining of your nose, and it tends to invade the cells at the back of your nose more than it does the ones in the front. So it's not that it's found in the mucus, it's actually found in the cells that line the back of your nose. So when they do a test, they shove a cotton swab back there and they rub it a lot, and it literally rubs off some of the superficial skin cells or mucus cells that are lining there, and that's where they can find the virus. The virus doesn't live in the mucus, it lives in the cells.
Very good, now I understand. Thank you. W7SHM.
Okay. Anyway, check and see if there's any other questions on this. It's important to know that there's a difference between virus and bacteria in terms of where they hang out in the body. And viruses are, you know, hijack your DNA and your cellular machinery. They get into cells and they start taking over the cell's protein and DNA reproduction system, making copies of themselves, but they're actually in the cells. They're not in your bloodstream for the most part. And so that's why they have to get the, you know, they're not in the mucus. So they are breathing them out when they're at that shedding phase. But it is interesting that's why somebody asked before, like, well, can't we just take the blood and, you know, filter it or something like that? No, that wouldn't help get rid of it in the cells. So that same kind of thing goes to that testing method. Are there any other questions for the doctor tonight? Okay, so I'll let her bring up another topic here, see what you guys think of this here.
So let's talk a little bit more about testing, particularly the difference between the testing to find if you have the virus, you know, what we call COVID positive, versus testing to see if you had it and are now maybe immune. I found a great study that was just published a couple of days ago where they had some people that were exposed, and they did these samples in the back of their nose every day from the day they were exposed through day 21. Man, their nose must have been really sore by then. But what they found is on day one, they had no positive results, and then gradually it increased, and by day five, which was the day usually that symptoms started, it turned out that they were about 40% of the people still had a negative result, even though that was when their symptoms started. The best results came at about day eight, and those people, by then it was about 75% of them were positive and 25% were falsely negative, and then it gradually went the other way. So it clearly, if you just do one swab of somebody's nose, you have at best a 25% chance that you're going to miss it. And if you're on the wrong day, you know, if you one day before symptoms, you have a two-thirds chance that you're going to miss it, which is why they're actually recommending for people that are in very sensitive positions and at high-risk positions that they actually have to have two tests now that are negative, separated by 72 hours. So people that maybe have been sick and they want to go back to work in somewhere where it's going to be a high risk that they would infect others, like maybe a nursing home, they have to have a negative test, and then they have to wait 72 hours and have another negative test, and they also have to be symptom-free. So the honest-to-God truth is right now, any single test out there isn't working all that great. What they're hoping to do instead is have these serology tests, and the FDA has already approved one, and there are about 10 others waiting to be approved, and if they're being approved this quickly, you know they haven't been tested very well. But what they're going to be measuring is whether you have antibodies in your system to the COVID virus. And it will be a blood test, not something that you have to have shoved up your nose, so you could get it done at any lab. These are really important to help decide who might be immune and safe to go back out in the world without any risk of getting sick again. There's still a lot of questions with them. First and foremost is how sensitive are they? It turns out there's more than one kind of antibody that your body makes after an infection, and we're not quite certain how much of the different types you have to have yet. But in the long run, this serology testing that you'll start hearing more and more about is probably going to be eventually our best way of telling if somebody has been infected and is immune, at least for now.
FYD?
Yes, Richard, FYD, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I know a lot of infectious diseases are transmitted via mosquitoes and other bugs. Can this be transmitted via mosquito or bugs, or do we know anything about it yet?
Nope, this one will not be transmitted by mosquitoes because it's not in your bloodstream. It lives in the cells of your nose, the back of your throat, and then the lining down into your lungs. And so when a mosquito bites you, it doesn't bite any of those places, so it can't pick up the virus and go somewhere else. There's no way it's going to be transmitted by bites or blood or those kinds of things, which is good news because as summer comes on, we know there's going to be a lot more mosquitoes out there. And that's at least one thing you won't have to worry about when you're enjoying your time outside is the only thing you can do outside of your house.
All right, go ahead, Richard.
I was heartbroken when I saw it in the tiger. Somehow or another, the idea of a tiger being really sick with COVID was much harder on me than thinking of a person. I don't know what that says about me, but it is very interesting. As far as what we know, it does look like there is some possibility that sick people can give it to their pets. It's not really easy. There haven't been a lot of them, but there have been a couple dogs and a tiger and maybe even a few cats out there that probably have the virus that they've gotten from their humans. But there is no evidence that they can give it back to you, which is really good. It may just be because they have very low-level illness. None of them seem to get very sick with it, and so they probably are not breathing out a lot of virus particles. But so far, there's no need to worry about petting your cat, having your dog give you a kiss, or those kinds of things.
Okay, again, there was a, actually I got an email from the Humane Society, at Willamette Valley Humane Society, with a link to this specific story, because they said that there was a concern. It said experimentally, they had done some work with cats and infected them on purpose, and then seeing whether the cats could pass it on to other cats. And in a closed setting, in a laboratory, they I haven't found the actual article yet, but they said that, yes, there was transmission from cat to cat if they were kept in close quarters together. So that was maybe of a bigger concern, you know, is if you're running an animal shelter. So that's one little other bit of evidence. I'm sure the story is unfolding. They did say that again. If you should do social distancing. If you are infected with COVID and you know it, you probably should keep the pet away from you because the pet could get it from you and be a carrier. Let Sheila talk about that a little bit.
The bigger reason for keeping your pets away from you if you're sick, however, is not that they're going to catch it and pass it on. It's that they're a surface. And so if you are sick and you are, you know, putting little droplets of virus on all the surfaces around you, and one of those surfaces is the cat that's snuggled in your lap, when that cat then walks into another room and climbs into your, wife's lap, there, and she pets them, guess what? She's now got COVID on her hands. So we do recommend that if you're sick, you are quarantined from everybody else in your family. You have no contact with the rest of your family. The doors are closed, et cetera. But in addition, that means that you have to be quarantined from the pets because you don't want the pet to carry the virus on their fur from the sick person's room to the rest of the house. And that's a far greater risk of infection than the cat catching it and then passing it to other cats or things like that.
LAW question.
Okay, David, I got you there because you're a regular. Kilo Golf 7, Lima Alpha Whiskey. I'll go ahead with the question.
Yeah, I miss pets. I love animals. I couldn't get any really answer the last time. I brought up that the question is, this is an unusual virus. It's not an average virus. Look how aggressive it is. I'm not trying to scare anybody, but is it possible that it could be genetically modified? And I mean, it's possible. You know, this is LAW there, back to the net.
First of all, in terms of this being a nasty virus, it is indeed a nasty virus compared to most of the ones we are used to, compared to influenza, compared to the cold viruses. This is nasty for several reasons. It's nasty. Actually, one of the nastiest things it does is it infects a lot of people that are then asymptomatic so that it can pass around without people even knowing it. That's a very nasty thing for a virus. Another nasty thing about it is that it has this very prolonged course, including a lot of people that get very sick and, you know, need several weeks to recover from. And that's very unusual for viruses. Another nasty thing about it compared to flu is that it probably infects 2 to 3 people for every one person that gets infected, something that we call the R-naught. And for flu, that's maybe, depending upon the year, one person with flu might infect a little bit less than one other person if you average it all out, whereas this one's 2 to 3. But if you want to compare that to, say, measles infects 10 to 15 people for every person that's infected. So if you really wanted to have a sneaky virus, measles is a far better one. It's also interesting, I've been looking a lot at measles lately because measles is so much easier to catch than COVID. That's why you hear once in a while when people haven't been vaccinated about outbreaks in classrooms and things. It is so much more infectious than COVID. And interestingly enough, they've never actually felt the need to put people in masks to prevent them from getting measles. So even though COVID is dangerous and scary, it's still not anywhere near as dangerous and scary as measles. It's nowhere near dangerous and scary as smallpox used to be, as polio, as a variety of other things that we've found treatments for.
LAW comment.
One more thing, though, about whether this could have been engineered. I can't say no, but it's not doing anything that would require engineering. People that have studied the coronaviruses have recognized that this was going to happen, and in fact, back when I was doing pandemic work in 2012, it was one of the most predicted pandemics in the world, and it was really thought it was just going to be a matter of time before we had a coronavirus pandemic. So it really just makes sense from a biological point of view that this would have happened sooner or later. It doesn't need to have been genetically engineered to do this. It really is what you would expect if you've been studying the natural history of these kind of viruses, both in people and in animals.
Okay, so very good. Another good question there. And it's the genetics of this thing is being very, very highly studied all around the world. We're able to now trace cases from their origin because of the genetics. The different sequences vary enough that, like, for example, we know now that a lot of the cases from New York apparently originated in Europe, not in China. So, you know, we know a lot about the genetics of this. It's a kind of a fascinating 33,000 base pair long strand of RNA wrapped up in protein that just is very, very good at what it does. So, not good for us, but is an interesting thing. And hopefully that will lead us to getting some various treatments and also some vaccines going. So anyway, other questions? So this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. We're talking about COVID-19 with Sheila Sund, MD.
LAW question.
Yeah, David, go ahead.
Well, you know, whether they could prove it or not or have any history, I believe in herbal medicine, but I just heard that if you take vitamin D and C and you take vitamin D and C and that it would help the immunity of the system, and zinc, that's what I was thinking of, zinc, and then I heard that was good. It may work, it may not work, but it could be, if people would try it, They might find out.
I have no problem trying the vitamin C, vitamin D, those kinds of things, other than the fact that a few of them, if you take those at high amounts, sometimes people have some GI side effects like diarrhea and cramping that are unpleasant. But if you don't, I don't think there's really going to be much harm to most of those. I have a little more concern about taking zinc because zinc, if you take it on an ongoing basis, can actually be toxic and do harm. People have been using it for colds for quite some time. There's actually been many, many, many studies on it. The answer is pretty vague. The bulk of the evidence says it doesn't work for colds, but it's not 100%. The bigger problem is they know at least to help with the cold virus, you have to take really large doses of it. And to have any effect whatsoever in the small studies that suggested it maybe helped. And if you took that kind of dose of the zinc on a long term for more than a week or two, it actually could become toxic to you. So it's one thing to take zinc for a few days when you were exposed to somebody with a cold. I'd be much more nervous about taking zinc during the whole COVID outbreak because at a dose where it's likely to help, it's also likely to do you major harm.
Is 100 milligrams a day too much?
Okay, yeah, so 100 milligrams of zinc is what you're saying, right? I'll just double check the number. She has her number. She's looking up on the table for you here. It sounds a little high.
Well, I just heard this recommendations from other, talk radio. I listen to a lot of talk radio there. But, it's interesting to know.
The 100 milligram dose is the dose that they've recommended for preventing people from getting a cold or maybe getting over a cold faster. That is too much. We know that anything more than 40 milligrams a day will lead to zinc toxicity. And in older people, it may even be less than that. It may be that if you're doing more than 20 milligrams a day. And the things that zinc can do to you, it can also cause GI distress. But it can cause headaches, it can cause diarrhea, it can even cause things like permanent loss of smell and taste. And since everybody thinks that's also what happens with COVID, you wouldn't know whether you were zinc toxic or coming down with COVID. So I would just be careful. I would not take a 100 milligram dose for more than a handful of days.
Okay, this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, and let's see, somebody else has a question about COVID-19.
Yeah, check in here in question. This is Kurt, Kilo 2, Sierra Uniform November.
Let's see, you're new to my log. Is it Kilo 7, Sierra Uniform November? Did I get that right?
Correction, it's Kilo 2, Sierra Uniform November.
Is that Kilo 2? I'm sorry, you're a little bit scratchy there.
Yes, affirmative, it's Kilo 2, Sierra Uniform November.
Okay, and you're Kurt, you said? Is that your, that's your name? Sorry.
Yeah, it's Kurt, Kilo Uniform Romeo Tango.
Okay, yeah, welcome, Kurt. You're new to my log, and go ahead with your question.
Yeah, so what I was wondering is, if you go to the grocery store, and like, let's say you buy some fruit, gallon of milk, bag of flour, things like that, would you be worried about disinfecting the product when you bring them home?
What I recommend when you bring anything into your house is the first thing you do is everything stops at a hot zone or a dirty zone right in front of your, right inside your door or right outside your door. That particularly includes your grocery bags. And they never come into your house at all because I would consider them potentially contaminated. If you need to put things away right away because they have to go in the refrigerator, things like a milk carton, we take them out, rub a disinfectant wipe over them and put them away. Same thing with fruits and vegetables. Take them out and you run them under water. You don't try and soap them or disinfect them. There's actually been some people that have gotten sick from consuming just soap while trying to wash their vegetables. So that is not recommended. But it is recommended that you rinse your fruits and vegetables off with water. For things you don't need to put away right away, if they're cardboard, just leave them in your hot zone for 24 hours. And for cardboard, that seems to be enough for the virus to die. But things that are smooth-sided, like glass or plastic, that you just are going to want to wipe off with some kind of disinfectant, a bleach solution, a disinfectant wipe. And if all else fails, then just wash it outside of the carton with some dish soap and a rag.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, that answered my question for you. All those good information there. This is Kilo 10 Victor, Uniform November, back to that.
Okay, so Kurt, you kind of broke up there on that last comment. You're welcome. Sorry, if there was a follow-up in there, you'll need to repeat it again.
Yeah, I'm on a handheld here, and my battery went dead, so I had to swap radios here real quick. So anyway, yeah, that answered my question. So this is K2SQN, and I will be clear. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Yeah, that helped a lot to have a new battery. That happens to me a lot. Okay, this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. Nearly out of time this evening. We are still taking questions about COVID-19. If you haven't checked in, that's fine. Just check in and give us the question.
Kilo India 70 Oscar X-ray.
Okay, there's Jay. Go ahead, please, with your Kilo India 7 Sierra Oscar X-ray.
Yeah, I know they say their underlying medical conditions like diabetes and hypertension that present a worse case scenario than not having them. But I'm wondering if they are differentiating between the people that are treated and the people that are untreated. For example, if you have hypertension and you're taking medications that give you a normal blood pressure, are you still higher at risk than people that don't have hypertension?
They're just starting to sort through a little bit of that now. And so a couple of the things that they found is the diseases that seem to make you most at risk are diabetes, underlying heart disease, and underlying lung disease, or something that messes up your immune system. How much the hypertension has to do with it is a little less certain. Yes, many people that are very sick with COVID have hypertension, but 61% of the people over the age of 65 have hypertension, just baseline. So it's not really clear yet whether hypertension is an independent risk factor or just the fact that it's the same age group. So that one's a little less clear. With all of these illnesses, whether it's diabetes, heart disease, lung disease, it does have a lot to do with how bad the underlying disease is. You know, if you've just had, you know, a touch of a little bit of lung disease, you're not going to be anywhere near in as much trouble as somebody that bounces in and out of the hospital once a year for lung disease. If you've got heart failure, you're not going to tolerate this as well as if you had a small heart attack 10 years ago and you've been fine since then. So it clearly has something to do with the severity of the disease and how much damage it's done to your body already. That will influence how much it will affect, or COVID will affect you.
Okay, well, that makes sense, and that answers my question. Thanks, KI7SOX.
Bravo, Uniform Victor, with a question.
Bravo, Uniform Victor, go ahead, please.
Expanding upon what the last question was, what if you're type 2 diabetes and you're well-maintained with a 5.9 A1C?
Again, they haven't broken that down yet. Right now they're just saying diabetes, but I can tell you the reason that diabetes is such a bad disease is not just that it makes your sugar go up. It's that by having your sugar be abnormal, as well as a lot of the other changes in your body, you're more likely to have heart disease. You're more likely to have problems with your peripheral nerves. There's more likely to have problems with your blood vessels. And so the diabetes, like anything else, if you've got a little touch of diabetes that's well controlled, it's probably a risk factor, but a very small one. Whereas if you have diabetes that's caused a lot of problems, you can't feel your feet, and you've had skin breakdown, and you've had two heart attacks, and it's been hard to control your sugar, it's going to be a much bigger risk.
Very good. Thank you. Back to that.
KI7SOX.
Was that SOX again? Is that Jay?
Yeah, this is Jay. Just one last question. Do they have any statistics of how many people have had severe symptoms or died that do not have any underlying symptoms? Medical conditions.
They haven't put those numbers together yet, but there are clearly a few. Particularly in some of the younger patients that seem to have it, that are perfectly healthy as far as we know, that have still died from it. It's a very small percent. It doesn't mean it's zero, but it's clearly less than 1% of the people that are younger and healthier are ending up dying from this. But exactly what the numbers are and how sure we are that they don't have any underlying conditions, that's going to take a long time to sort out.
Okay, thank you.
And we got to get going, but I wanted to end up with one other study that I came across recently. It was another study that's looked at how virus lives on different things. We'd had one study about that a couple weeks ago, and somebody has now replicated that. That's always good, because when you find a couple people getting similar results, you can have much greater confidence that it's true. So again, they put virus on different surfaces and then looked to see how long it died. And they found that on paper, really after 3 hours, it was gone. On wood and cloth, it was gone by the second day. On surfaces like glass and, interestingly, banknotes, it took about 4 days to go away. And on stainless steel and plastic, they actually found it up to 7 days. So those are definitely, those smooth surfaces are the ones you want to worry about cleaning and disinfecting the most. The other thing they did is they tried a variety of different common disinfectants on the virus and saw how well they worked. And it said that virtually every common disinfectant they tried worked just about the same after 5 minutes. Strong bleach solution, weak bleach solution, the ethanol hand sanitizers, the chlorhexidine, the betadine, all of them pretty much eliminated all the virus after 5 minutes. And just plain hand soap was not quite as good, but it was still completely gone at 15 minutes. So it doesn't really matter what you disinfect with, or even if you don't have a disinfectant, just clean it really good. It seems that works really well, but you want to make sure you do that if you're trying to get virus off, particularly any kind of smooth surface.
KE7ASM.
Gate, timer, cancel.
Okay, Doug, well, you timed out at the very end there, but let's get the doctor's comment on Mupirocin, and then we'll close up.
MRSA is a bacterial infection. It's a staph bacteria, and it's... most of us have staph on our skins at all time, but we don't have the MRSA strain of it. MRSA stands for methicillin-resistant staph aureus. And so staph is an incredibly common bacteria. And as the world has had more antibiotics dumped into it, it is a bacteria that has a strain now that's resistant to many infections, and that's called MRSA. It's a horrible thing, and it can be hard to treat. Your medication, the mupirocin that you use, is an antibacterial ointment, so it works really good for staph and a couple other bacterias, but it won't do anything for COVID because it's a virus. And so even though it can keep your staph under control, it won't protect you from getting COVID in any way, shape, or form, nor could it be used to treat it, because it's like treating a completely different species.
Okay, well, we are out of time this evening. Really good questions this evening. The time is now 8:11 p.m. And this concludes the 529 Emergency Preparedness Special COVID-19 Friday Evening Edition. So far, we're meeting on each Tuesday and Friday evenings at 7 p.m. on 145.29 megahertz. And our thanks go out to Dan, WA7ABU, for the use of the repeater. Thank you to our special guest, Sheila Sund, MD, a local retired physician who studies all things COVID just for fun. Yeah. Thanks to all who participated today and those who stood by to give us a clear channel. This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, closing the net now, 8:12 p.m. Have a good evening. Look for the recording later on if you want to listen to this again. We now return the repeater to normal, undirected amateur operations. Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, I'm clear.